welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, bringing you an hour of science fiction. Later, an episode of X-1 from 1957, but right now, it's Escape, featuring T.S. Stribling's story, The Green Splotches. The story, first published in 1920, made its way to Escape on March 31st, 1950, and according to producer, director, and co-writer William N. Robeson, it has been modernized and adapted for radio. Author Stribling actually came a long way to get this story to print. From his early days with a law firm, he was actually in three of them within 2 years because it was found that rather than working on his cases for the legal firms he worked for, he was instead using the office supplies like pencils and paper and a typewriter to hone in his craft of writing. He penned a lot of adventure stories throughout the 1920s, this being one of them, a mix of adventure and sci-fi, and would go on to win the Pulitzer Prize for a novel in 1932 with his book, The Store. Stribling's story, The Green Splotches, is also one of the more celebrated early science fiction works in literature. In fact, in 1943, the first paperback anthology of science fiction ever included his story, The Green Splotches, also tales by Ambrose Bierce and H.G. Wells. This next broadcast of Escape, not exactly indicative of the entire anthology series in terms of its survival and quality throughout the years. Many of the broadcasts of Escape that we know and hear today were taken directly from the master, but to my ears, this sounds like an off-air recording or a transcription disc or reel that wasn't very well taken care of. This great story is intelligible, just a warning, it's not exactly top-notch in terms of quality. Again, the CBS broadcast from March 31st, 1950, Tuned to Yesterday, offers you Escape.
In a science fiction classic, Green Splotches. There is no longer any doubt in my mind. Though he walked like a man and talked like a man, Mr. Three was not a man, but a plant. And his country, which he called One, is not to be found upon the earth. It is the only possible conclusion to make after what happened to us in the valley of the Infernal River. The three of us constituted the DeLong geographical expedition to explore and map the wild, uncharted region of the Andes between Peru and Chile. There was our leader, Professor Anton Demetrius, once of the University of Bucharest, and now one of America's most distinguished adopted scientists.
In the valley of the Rio Infernillo, we should find some very significant geological evidence which may well change our present conception of the age of our planet.
There was young Leroy Haskell, the secretary of the expedition, Phi Beta Kappa, Ph.D., and, as far as I was concerned, a scientific camp follower. He had written a book.
The material I shall gather on this junket will make a book that should simply dwarf the success of my reindeer in Iceland. And you know how well received it was.
Then, of course, there was me, John Preston. My job was to survey the region and map it for the first time. There were two native guides, Jose and Pablo. We had been warned from the first. Everyone told us to stay away from the valley of the Infernal River, from which they all said no traveler has ever returned. But we were not to be dissuaded from our purpose. So after a week on the high mountain trails, we came at last to the entrance of the valley. A chasm that could hold 10 Grand Canyons. A vast and forbidding valley. Black, dark brown, and deep gray. A horrible scar. The flesh of the earth burned to a crisp. And far, far below, the twisting gray shimmer of the Rio Infernillo.
This is the place, senor. The valley del Rio Infernillo.
Do we start back now?
We'll spend the next 60 days in this valley.
There was no trail. The mules and pack llamas picked their way between boulders, ranging in size from a man's head to his house. Jose led the body, rifle at ready, alert for the slightest danger. The way was steep, pushing us forward against the pommels of our saddles, jostling and jouncing us.
It would not be exact to say that I was frightened by this forbidding valley of desolation, but I was depressed by it as I rode along. I was lost in speculation about the warnings we had received when a rifle shot rang.
Did you see him?
What?
A man or something behind that rock.
Jose had slipped from his saddle, his rifle barrel still smoking.
Jose, come back here.
But he had disappeared among the boulders, swiftly stalking an unseen prey.
What was he, Pablo? Did you see?
Yes. It was a man. Look, there they go. Down there between the rocks.
Come on. We slipped from our mules and started down toward the spot where we had seen Jose running after a fleeting, yellowish figure.
It is Jose. Hurry.
But when we got there, all we found was... That was all, except a splotch of green liquid on the stone, and smaller splotches of green splashed on one boulder after another, leading off toward the river. We followed the trail of green splotches, but they dwindled out a quarter of a mile away. We searched for Jose all afternoon, but finally gave up. Toward sundown, pitched our camp near the rocks with the green splotches. While Pablo prepared the evening meal, Professor Demetrius finished a chemical analysis of the green stain.
Well, gentlemen, this material is chlorophyll.
Chlorophyll?
Pure chlorophyll. The substance that makes all plants green.
Where would chlorophyll come from in this godforsaken place where there aren't even any plants?
That is a mystery we must set out to solve.
Oh, look. Look, the moon's rising.
Apropos of nothing.
I like to watch the moon rise. I find it a source of inspiration.
Source of inspiration. Sometimes that knuckle-headed secretary was more than I could bear. In the midst of the riddle of the chlorophyll, he seeks the inspiration of the rising moon. Nevertheless, a moment later, the professor and I also stepped out of the tent into the crisp evening air. Far down at the eastern end of the valley, the disk of the rising moon glimmered between two towering peaks.
It looks whiter and more silvery in this latitude.
She wears a cloud of mist like the veil of a bride.
Does she now?
Look, dear person, just because you lack the gift of imagery is no reason for... My God, look!
Hmm?
The moon, the new moon, setting in the west.
He was right. Low in the luminescent western sky was the thin, delicate crescent of the new moon. And to the east, the full moon, which we'd been watching, had disappeared. A phosphorescent mist still hung about the peak. And as we watched, it slowly faded away. And left the valley of the infernal river in deepest blackness. It was more than my mind could cope with, but it didn't bother our bright young man. Next evening, Leroy had a curious report for us.
Well, I sold a copy of my book today, Reindeer Nighting.
What?
Yes, I got this for him.
Gold. Nuggets of gold.
Yes, that's right.
Who did you sell it to?
Yes, what sucker gave you all that gold?
An Indian.
Indian? What happened?
Well, I was down the valley where they were gathering specimens of flora, and I just sat down to eat my lunch when I saw this Indian behind the rock staring at me. Then he saw the corner of the book sticking out of my knapsack. He pointed at it and he said, "What is that, reindeer in Iceland?" I was surprised. And then he said just what I had been thinking. That book has a wider reputation than you imagine. I thought it'd be quite a gag to sell one of my books to a Peruvian Indian, so I went into a long spiel about what a really fine and useful book it is.
That shouldn't have been difficult for you.
It wasn't. I ended by telling him that he could have this valuable and excellent example of American literature for only $3.50. What is $3.50? He said, "Have I got $3.50? I was just wondering about that," I said. "Now turn your pockets inside out and you'll see." He did. And a lot of pieces of metal spilled on the ground. I took the gold nuggets and told him I'd include the other four copies I brought along. He's dropping back more for them.
That's nice.
I think I'll tune in soon, quite a day.
Yes, hasn't it?
If I'd brought more copies of my book, I could clean up down here.
Next morning, I was awakened by the sound of groaning coming from Haskell's cot. What I saw there awakened me with a start and yanked me to my feet. Professor Demetrius.
Professor. John, what's the matter?
Come here quickly, please. Something's wrong with Leroy.
What is it?
Look.
Is that Leroy?
Yes.
His hair is turned white.
Overnight.
What in the world happened to him?
I don't know. Yes, Leroy. Come on, old boy, wake up. Come on, Leroy, wake up. Come on, fellow, wake up. Come on.
What's the matter?
Now, how do you feel?
Do you hurt anywhere?
My head aches and... My leg bone.
Where?
Let me see. Here, you know, on my thigh.
Well, that's a pretty nasty inflammation.
More like a third-degree burn. Right under your trousers pocket. Leroy.
Yes.
Did you carry that gold in this pocket yesterday?
Why, yes.
And where was it last night?
I put it under my pillow for safekeeping.
Yes, and that accounts for it. That gold is poisoned in some way.
Poisoned?
Oh, no.
What's the matter?
Here in the mirror. Is that me? Thinking, did that step turn my hair white? Just tell him. Tell him.
Yes, my boy, it's it.
Oh, no, it's no. Just look. Look, there he is.
I looked up. Standing in the entrance of the tent was an Indian with an enormous head and sickly painted face. He was wearing the usual white shirt and trousers of the cholo, and he was smiling a faint, ironic smile which made me dislike him intensely. The professor was first to recover from the shock of his appearance.
Did you give our young man here some gold yesterday?
I gave the young man some gold for some
soup. Did you know the gold was poison?
Poison?
How? Well, that's what we want you to tell us.
I haven't any idea. What effect did it have?
You can see for yourself.
Is this the same young man?
Yes, you nearly killed him.
Oh, how interesting. It must be the effect of a metal I carried with the gold. I do not know what you call it in your language. Possibly you may never have heard of it. Here, son.
But it's radium. Pure metallic radium.
Yes, John. More radium than is known to exist in the entire civilized world. And carried around casually in the pocket of an Indian.
But I was burned by the gold.
That's right. But the gold had become irradiated by this piece of radium, which I might add is worth several million dollars.
We made a bad deal, Leroy. You should have taken the radium and let the gold alone.
I wish I'd given the book away.
Can't you gentlemen ever communicate with each other without using words and sentences?
What?
Suppose, Mr. Preston, you desire to communicate with Mr. Benitez.
How do you know my name? Have we met somewhere before?
I'm sure we have not. But when I paused, you thought your name. So naturally, I knew it at once. I believe that's the ancient word for it. Mr. Preston, I perceive that you want to know my name. Well, I have a number. In my country, the citizens are numbered. I'm sure when your own countries become densely populated, you too will adopt an numerical nomenclature.
What is your number?
1,752 deaths, 12,657,109 deaths, 654 deaths.
That might become a little hard to remember. Where do you come from, Mr. Lee?
The name of my country is One, or Turk. I dare say each of you comes from a country which you call One. No. I see I'm wrong. America? Romania? Very pretty name, but quite unscientific.
Can you read our thoughts before we speak?
Certainly. I take the language formed right out of your own mind and use them. If the creature has no language at all, one can see this easy. So it's out of the aluminum age, and that arose from the prehistoric steel age. A very heavy, clumsy metal, I have heard archaeologists say.
Oh, breakfast, Pablo. Good. Set it up on the table there.
See, your Preston. He is the one.
What then?
That man there, he murdered Jose.
What?
Everything he has on is Jose. He wears Jose's clothes and his shoes. On his finger is Jose's silver ring. I know it. I saw him that day when Jose disappeared.
Are you sure, Pablo?
Si, ciertamente.
Pablo is quite right, gentlemen.
You admit that you killed Jose?
Oh, yes.
You realize, Mr. Three, that your confession will place you in jeopardy of the law.
Oh, then you do have laws in your country.
Well, naturally. Pablo, take that rope there and tie Mr. Three to that chair.
Si, senor.
You may consider yourself under arrest, sir. Give Pablo a hand, Leroy. Time securely.
It will be a pleasure.
We will have to carry him before a magistrate. That is not inconvenient.
Professor Demetrius, you have studied physiology?
Yes.
And perhaps vivisection?
Yes.
Then why all this fuss about the killing of a lower animal for scientific ends?
A lower animal? Mr. Three Weeks are all human beings. Granted, Jose did not have the intelligence or culture such as we had. Nevertheless, he was a human being.
Senor Prince, the pack animal, course, they've broken out of the corral.
I rushed from the tent, followed by Leroy and the professor. The mules and the llamas had indeed broken through the corral fence. They were stampeding down the valley as if the fields had a devil itself. Pablo tried to head them off, desperately shouting and waving his arms, but his efforts seemed silly in the face of their headlong flight. And then my attention was diverted in another direction.
Preston, look! Our tent's on fire!
It was. A sheet of flame licked up the oil canvas and enveloped the ridge.
Our prisoner! We're burned to death in there!
I'll get him!
I ran back to the tent, pulled up the stakes to the rear wall, and shoved into the smoke-filled tent. Mr. Three was still sitting in the chair where we tied him. He slumped queerly, and the brim of his hat had dropped onto his shirt. There was no time to untie him. I picked him up, chair on oil, and rushed out of the tent just as the walls collapsed. It occurred to me that he was remarkably light.
John, is he all right?
Suffocated, I said.
His clothes are burning. Help me beat out the flames. Hey, what's
this? Escalade.
The clothes are empty.
No, not quite.
The professor tore open Jose's clothes and pulled from within a human skin.
What in the world?
This is the skin of Jose.
How do you know?
See, there on his arm. The tattoo of the cross.
Yes, I remember Jose had such a tattoo.
What does it mean?
It means that somebody or something has been stalking us. Disguised in this...
But I don't...
Exactly as a hunter stalks a deer in a deer robe.
Then it wasn't a human being?
It was the devil. They wonder.
He knows he's a human being, but he doubts if we are. Did you notice how supercilious he was? He probably thinks of us as the missing link between the apes and himself. We are animals to him. He puts on one of our skins to hunt us down. As we stood in the merciless sunshine in that black valley of hell, we were four frightened men. Powerless to combat the kind of magic or witchcraft or super science which opposed us. And then I noticed a strange thing. A rabbit broke from behind a boulder and dashed between our feet, scampering down the valley toward the river. I looked up and saw Vicuna leaping from boulder to boulder. And there, slipping between the rocks, was a panther. Suddenly, the whole valley seemed alive with flying animals, all rushing headlong toward the river. Rat, Hattar, Civet, and finally a huge Yukamare, the great black bear of the Andes. Lumbered by so close to us, we had to jump out of his way. But he paid us no heed. He was too intent on following the others toward the river.
Now, what in the world?
Look, up the valley, hopping from rock to rock.
What are they?
They look like yellow fleas from here.
Whatever they are, they must be what stampeded our pack animals.
It is the devil driving all the animals into hell.
Look again, Pablo. They're getting bigger. They look like men to me. Yellow men. With the agility of mountain goats. As the strange hopping figures approached, we could see that they carried some kind of short metal rod that flashed in the sun. The closer they came, the more animals rushed by us. Devil or no devil, it was too much for Pablo. As a beautiful speckled deer came into view, Pablo raised his rifle.
Don't shoot. There must be no holes in the skin.
We swirled around. Behind us on a large boulder stood Mr. Three. He was naked, having shed Jose's skin. His face still carried the red paint of his Indian masquerade, but the rest of his body was a soft yellow, like a ripe peach. His feet were disagreeably small, which accounted for the ease with which he escaped our rope. In his hand, he carried a small metal rod.
I must apologize for setting fire to your tent, gentlemen. It was quite accidental. I did it with this focusing rod as I slipped out of your rope.
Focusing rod?
Yes.
Well, what does it focus?
Radio power.
Why, that is the most compact transmitter I've ever seen.
It's really quite primitive. I imagine it came into use among thinking creatures along with fire, the keystone of the arsenal of a motion control rocket. They were all important additions to human knowledge, but their discoverers and the dates of their discovery are lost in prehistoric eras. You men will follow the rest of the quarry to the river. Everyone must go.
What did you say?
Follow the rest of the animals to the river. Be quick about it.
Now look here, three. We'll do as we please.
Why should we go?
So our commander can select specimens to carry to the land of one.
Oh, I see. He wishes our scientific advice on the selection of animals.
Your advice? You? You bunch of idiots. He's going to select one of you as a specimen to carry to one. Now get along. I don't want to have to use force.
You won't get us any other way. Take cover, men!
The four of us threw ourselves behind the boulders. Mr. Three didn't move. He still stood on top of his rock a dozen feet away. I raised my rifle, got his huge, ugly head in my sight, and squeezed the trigger. But the gun never fired. And suddenly my arms and legs were contorted in painful spasms. My body stiffened, and it seemed as though my brain were on fire. When I opened my eyes, I was flat on the ground, and so were my companions.
I think that you are convinced now of the futility of opposition. So shall we stroll together in the direction of the river?
You realize that you're creating an international incident. The United States of America does not stand for such treatment of its citizens. You'd better think twice. This thing can get out of hand. It may even become a matter for the consideration of the United Nations. And it can certainly lead to war.
Indeed. That should be interesting. Professor, do you creatures really represent a scientific body?
Why, of course we do. The DeLong Institution.
How quaint.
And I'd like to have some things explained.
I'd be very happy to oblige if I can. Oh, yes, I perceive your question. We are here to extract radium from the pitchblende in this valley. We do this with a portable furnace. The strange light you saw in the evenings occurred when we moved our furnace from place to place. We always do that at night. To do so during the day is inconvenient because the sun's rays I'll have to create a local ether storm.
Yes, I can see that it's mine.
Hey, look.
What?
Look ahead there. A flying saucer to end all flying saucers.
As we rounded a huge boulder, there stood an enormous cylinder of metal. It towered at least 750 feet into the air and rested on a stone which could not have been more than 4 feet in diameter. Its huge bulk shored up by metal rods several hundred feet long, which protruded from the ship where the barrel began to taper towards the stern. 500 feet up the side of the cylinder were controlling planes, which looked tiny in comparison to the great bulk, and indicated that it must travel through space at inconceivable speed. Around the base of the ship, squads of yellow men were rounding up the animals in cages and throwing them aboard. They worked with military precision, obviously under orders. Although no sound was uttered, since all communication was mental, as we approached the ship, four yellow men appeared with a large cage. And from a porthole about 75 feet above the stern, another yellow man with a scintillating star on his forehead stared down at us. Mr. Three drew himself up stiffly and saluted. What followed was a one-sided conversation put into words by Mr. Three, apparently for our benefit.
Yes, sir. No, sir. Ordinary ruby-blooded mammals, sir, with intelligence somewhat higher than monkeys, sir. They communicate with simple thoughts exactly as monkeys do, sir, by chattering. They are absolutely insensible to all mental vibrations, sir, more completely than the four-legged animals. I would suggest you take all four. They will prove very amusing, sir, in the National Zoo. Their attempts to deceive each other and even me, sir, are quite ridiculous. I believe you will find them much more humorous than chimpanzees. Sorry you haven't the stage. In that case, I suggest you take the brown one. He is the best physical specimen and obviously better adapted to his habitat. None of them have any minds to see, sir. Very well, sir.
As the yellow men closed in on him, Pablo took out his knife, slashing and stabbing at his assailant. And every time his knife found a mark, green liquid spurted from the yellow body. They finally disarmed him.
and an answer to the thrust that one of the little three sent.
I can't use my focusing rod. It might destroy what little mind he has.
A moment later, they were carrying Pablo by arms and legs to the beach. He turned his pathetic, bloody face toward me.
Senor Francis, for the love of Holy Mary, save me! Save me!
And something snapped in my brain. I started toward Pablo's captive. Mr. Three leveled his focusing rod, and my brain seemed on fire, and everything went black. When I came to, the yellow men had vanished. The spaceship stood poised in the light of the setting sun. Their ports and hatches closed. The professor and Leroy were leaning over me.
John, are you all right, John?
I guess so.
That jolt he gave you must have been a nasty one.
I'd rather like the electric chair out of it.
George!
The stern of the spaceship, a luminous gas seemed to boil out in whirls of furious flashes. The returning rods were tapped off and the huge cylinder shot straight up into the air with a precision.
Blue, green, yellow, orange, red. And this is...
You mean
exactly, John. It was going so fast, the light of the exhaust ran through the entire color spectrum. It was traveling at least at the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second.
Look, look at that phosphorescent glow. It's all over the hill.
Yes. It's all over us.
Yes.
I believe we are covered with the residual emanations of radium. I suggest we go down to the river and wash it off. Otherwise, it will presently kill us.
Professor?
Yes?
Did you notice the green liquid spurting from those creatures when Pablo knifed them, like green blood?
It was not blood.
It was chlorophyll.
But how could...
You see, gentlemen, Mr. Three and his comrades were not animals. They were plants.
But... possible.
But true. Well, Leon, you should be able to write quite an interesting book about this expedition. One that might even outsell Reindeer in Iceland.
Yes, Professor. But who would believe it?
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson. Tonight, we have presented Green Splotches, written in 1920 by T.S. Tribbling and modernized and adapted for radio by Mr. Robeson. Featured in the cast were Bill Conrad as Preston and Paul Fries as Professor Demetrius. Also heard were Ted DeCostia, Harry Bartell, Barton Yarborough, and Jay Novello. Special music was arranged and conducted by Del Castillo. Next week...
You're trapped on a lost plateau. In the shadowy depths of the Grand Canyon, at your feet lies a fortune in ancient gold, and beside you, holding a gun at your head, is a half-crazed Indian from whom there is no escape.
Next week, we escape with the story of a man who faced the murderous fanaticism of an ancient tribe to recover a fabulous treasure in golden relics. As Paul Pierce tells it in Grand Canyon Sweet. Goodbye, then, until the same time next week, when once again we offer you Escape. Maybe you think there's no such thing as flying saucers, but Charlie McCarthy claims to have captured a flying saucer pilot, and he gets Van Heflin into the plot this Sunday night. You'll find it as merry a spin as Charlie and Edgar Bergen have taken you on. And there's plenty of fun earlier when Al Jolson trades gags with Jack Bennett.
Escape, I'm tuned to yesterday from the 31st of March, 1950, a CBS radio broadcast. You're listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark LeVonier. Now on to the NBC series X-1 with an episode called Inside Story by Richard Wilson. This episode first heard on the National Broadcasting Company on June 20th, 1957.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, Three, two, X minus one, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future. Adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents... Inside Story by Richard Wilson.
Every wire serviceman knows that when the legislature shuts down for the hot weather, when it gets too warm for crimes of passion, that's the start of the silly season. It's the time when the teletype chatters about the largest pumpkin grown in Sauk County and the dog that found its way home from Luna Base through the Cocoa Island rocket port. Well, it was the silly season when I reported to headquarters Martian sector of the Galactic News Service at IOPA. I found the bureau chief, Scott Warren, looking sourly at a strip of copy.
GNS Sonala add lizards.
Lizards?
Lizards. New light on the longevity span of the Martian sand lizard was shed today by the Sonala Zoological Society. Now, that is what I call hot news. Flash copy.
Dull day?
Following a dull night. Was it like this in New York when you left?
They had me covering a kitten in a tree in Gramercy Park.
I would sell my soul for a nice juicy cabinet crisis. Or else a little honest graft on a spaceport contract.
Well, have you got any leads?
No. The Garrison Administration of Martian Colonial Affairs is depressingly honest.
When nothing's doing, you can stir it up a little. You know, rattle the local skeleton in the closet. Fan the fires a little.
Have you read the Publications Responsibility Act of 1997? You can get 20 years for what you were thinking.
Look, what's the local canker sore? What would you like most to get an inside story on? Something everybody covers up.
Well, there's Druro. Oh, but that's Simon Pure.
What's Druro?
Nully Sanctuary.
Oh, a religious institution?
No. It's a quarantine set up for null gravity neurocatenosis. Nully fever. It's completely segregated. Nobody's ever gotten a report out of there.
Well, it sounds like a natural.
Look, George, you're new. You don't fool around with nully fever here on Mars. Be like lighting a cigarette in a powder magazine.
Chief, how would you like an inside story out of Druro?
You can't get in.
I will give 8 to 5. Now, look, who's in charge?
The Ministry of Health, but you can't...
Okay, okay. Don't let the sand lizard take up all the space. I will get in. It wasn't so easy. I did fine over at the health ministry until I mentioned Druro. And then I might just as well have had a galloping case of nully fever myself. I was referred to the press officer, to the assistant administrator, to the legal department, the protocol division, and then back to the press officer. Finally, I got in to see the commissioner, Dr. Marks.
Just what caused you to raise the question of Druro, Mr. Gordon?
Look, Dr. Marks, what I want is your permission to visit Druro and get the inside story.
Visit Druro? You mean inside the camp?
Yes, that's right.
Mr. Gordon, I am quoting Administrative Code, Section 65. Any person found within the perimeter at Druro is considered to be a nully fever victim. Contagion is something like 99% certain at a range of 100 yards.
What's the treatment?
Druro.
You mean they're just shoved there to rot?
A nully, Mr. Gordon, will rot wherever he is. He deteriorates to the point of total sterility. Take my advice. Forget it.
Mm-hmm. Naturally, I didn't forget it. I did more research. I found out that Nulli fever seemed to be a mutated virus that got that way in the early Earth-Mars rockets that had inadequate radiological shielding. The symptoms masqueraded as half a dozen diseases, but the end product was the same. A physical deterioration that I don't care to go into. And a psychological lowering to an animal state.
Listening to Inside Story on X-1. We'll return to our program in just a moment. But first, how would you like to make $1,000? Probably the first question that comes to your mind is, what do I have to do? The answer is just as simple. Plan to spend some time in jail. Making money has become an attractive, although highly illegal profession for some people. But counterfeiting isn't worth the paper it's printed on. And counterfeiters always end up with more dollars than cents, thanks to a branch of the United States Treasury Department called the United States Secret Service. As an important part of its work, the Secret Service has the job of tracking down counterfeiters and seeing to it that they are put out of circulation, along with their phony bills and lead nickels. The Secret Service also makes sure that the president and his family are protected at all times and acts as the president's personal bodyguard. During election years, the Secret Service also provides a special bodyguard for the president-elect. But to get back to what we were talking about first, the main duty of the Secret Service is to make sure that none of us makes or takes any wooden nickels. Now, back to X-1 and Inside Story.
I may be a little reckless following a story, but believe me, there isn't a bonus big enough to make a hero out of me. I had no intention of contracting Nulli fever just to provide a byline story for old GNS. I had stumbled onto something, and I was wearing it when I dropped into the bureau and asked Scott if he noticed anything different about me.
You're putting on a little weight?
No. Guess again.
Your pants aren't hanging right. Your shirt's all bunched up.
That's because I am wearing the latest fashion, an invisible suit.
Oh, goodbye. Try another one.
Look, I'm not kidding. It's heat-proof and airtight. They developed it over at Mars Electronics for spacesuit use.
You mean you're all buttoned up? Well, how do I hear you?
Short wave from a miniaturized dental mic. It's hanging on a front tooth, see?
You're not kidding. Well, how come it's invisible?
It beats me. Something to do with a non-refractive coating. You need that for dark side work on airless satellites. I got an experimental model from a PRO at ME.
What's it good for?
Outside of spaceship work, not much. Except it is my ticket to Druro.
Now, wait a
minute. Don't you get it, Chief? I can't be infected, not with this suit on. It's absolutely airtight. Don't worry, I'll be safe. Wrapped in plastic film like chewing gum.
Yeah, but that won't get you past the perimeter into the Nulli camp.
Just leave that to me. I've got that figured out, too. I picked up a sand cat out to the town of Druro and waited for 2 days. There was a shipment of Nullis, the last of the Sinala roundup due at the camp. Out of respect to public opinion, they dump Nullis at night, which suited me fine. About 100 Nullis were going over the newcomers like kangaroo caught in a frontier jail. I don't think anybody actually got killed, but they almost tore the new bunch to pieces, grabbing cigarettes, jackknives, buttons, shoes, anything. And then, like as not, the old-timers would fight each other for it. The whole thing was over at dawn, and I could get a look around the camp. There were prefab huts and some trees. I started over to one of the huts.
My hut.
Take it easy, friend. I'm not going to hurt you. Look, I'm your friend.
Sure. You think you're going to steal my ration, huh? I'll kill you first.
How long have you been here?
2 years.
Got a cigarette?
Here. No, no, don't grab. I'll toss you one.
Don't you make a move towards me.
Sure, sure, sure. What were you before you got in here?
Huh? A teacher. An IOPA technical. I fixed them before they got me. I cut down 10 medics with a power drill.
When is breakfast, friend?
You go plenty hungry. Ration isn't till tomorrow. You think there was some fight last night? Wait till you see ration drop. Last time somebody tried to beat me to a ration case, I fixed her.
Never mind, never mind. Don't tell me about it. Hey, what's that over there? Up the hill. Looks like a regular fortress.
What are you trying to do? Hurt me?
No. No, I just asked you what goes on up there, those other huts inside that barricade.
You spying for them? Yeah, sure. You're spying for them, you dirty... You!
It isn't easy to get used to dodging nasty backhand punches that came out of the blue and were meant to kill, if possible. I got my arm up in time to catch about half the force, and the man ran off with my pack of cigarettes. But there was something up that hill worth looking into. A barricaded section set apart from the rest. So I started up. When I hit the woods, I stopped just 3 feet short of a 10-foot spear.
All right, you. Get back down the hill.
Now, take it easy, will you? What's going on up here?
Go on, get moving. I've got orders to kill if I have to.
You don't understand. I just want to find out...
Yeah, sure you do. They always do. Every time there's a new batch, there's a few still smart enough to plan together, and they come up here spying.
Spying on what? Look, I'm a newspaper...
I'll count three, and then you get it in the belly.
No hero, I got before he reached 1.5. That night, I managed to talk to the ex-teacher without either of us slugging the other. I asked him about the guard on the hill.
They get all the best rations. They make us give up our food or they come kill us. They've got spears, knives.
You mean there's a gang up there living off the rest of you?
Yeah, yeah. I killed one of them once. Caught him from behind with a rock. They came down and killed 10 of us. Didn't get me, though. Funny, huh?
I got the picture. It's been the same every time men are herded together like animals. Andersonville, Buchenwald, and Dachau, the Alaskan camps in the 70s, and now Druro. The strong live off the others, a kind of racketeering in spades. Grab the best of everything, live as rich as you can, and don't worry how many you leave to starve to death.
We're gonna get them, though. Tonight. Got rocks together and clubs. Go up there and we'll get them. You come.
I didn't have much choice. They would have torn me apart. About 10 o'clock at night, the mob gathered at the foot of the hill. Every once in a while, they'd swipe at each other with a club or a rock, but mostly they shouted up at the hill. And then suddenly, without any signal, they charged. It was kind of sick. Men and women, heaven knows what they were before, teachers, mothers, anything, screaming and running up that hill. And then the defenders cut loose. There were torches so I could see, rocks rolled down, boiling water, spears, arrows, enough to cut down that unarmed mob. I was hiding behind a tree now, sick, good and sick, when it happened.
Hold on, bud. I'm going to pull this arrow out. Here goes now.
Where am I?
Up the hill. That's where you wanted to go, isn't it?
But how did...
We dragged you up here.
Herb, get some bandages up here.
You're one of them, aren't you?
One of who?
The big shots, the kingpins, gangsters.
You didn't get hit in the head, did you?
Oh, it's too bad they didn't wipe you out up here. It's tough enough living in a place like this, but to prey on the weak ones...
Look, fella, I think maybe you got the wrong idea.
Oh, thank heaven I'm safe from this kind of...
Yeah, I wondered when you'd notice. That fancy suit of yours got torn when the arrow hit.
Oh, no. No. Nolly fever.
That's why we hauled you up here. We spotted something funny about you. A kettle of boiling water splashed on you and you didn't even notice. Who are you?
George Gordon, Galactic News Service.
A newsman? Listen, does anybody know you're in here?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a chance. Can you tell them they got to let us out? Tell them what it's like up here. Make them understand. We write messages for the ration planes and they ignore them. You can't get close enough to the guards to shout, they shoot you down. They got to let us out.
Oh, sure, sure. After what I've seen, that's the last thing I do. Try to con somebody into letting this loose on the population. I've seen enough nullies. Even if I have to spend the rest of my life in this camp, I don't want to be responsible for making more.
Wait a minute. You don't get it. We're not nullies up here.
What? Nobody gets in the camp who isn't a nully.
That's right. We all had it when we came in, but not anymore. Up here, we're cured.
You're lying.
You've got to believe me. We've been living up here for 4 years, keeping guard. Trying to live like human beings in the middle of those animals down there. Losing maybe 3 or 4 a week, fighting them off.
You know, you're more dangerous than they are down there because somehow you've kept some intelligence, enough to want revenge on the rest of the world by infecting.
No, no, you've got to believe me. We're cured. Nolly fever can be cured somehow because we've done it. About 100 of us. More now with the babies.
The what?
Babies. Normal, healthy babies.
He pointed across the clearing to another hut, and I saw it. A woman about 30, sitting on the doorsteps, nursing a baby, an infant. And I heard the words of the commissioner echoing in my ear. And of course, total sterility. These weren't nullies, not anymore. If they could have babies, they must be cured. Living as a desperate island in a mad world of violence. Well, you know the rest of it. You ought to. It was carried under my byline in every fact sheet on 3 planets. They had a micro-technician up the hill who gimmicked my miniature microphone with a hairpin and a piece of quartz crystal, so I cut in on the main traffic beam between Sinala and Iopa. I had Scott Warren at Government House in 15 minutes threatening to blow the lid off the whole colonial government. The babies did it. Aerial photographs with micro-enlargements. They had pictures of those babies on the wire the next day. Red tape held it up a week. But finally, 100 cured ex-nullies and 1 reporter were out of Druro at Iopa General Hospital for checks. They found it. Nully fever is psychosomatic. You take somebody strong enough to fight for survival, give him incentive, and he'll lick it by himself. No miracle drugs needed. It starts with a virus, all right. But it ends with psychotherapy. A good dose of willpower. I got back to work in a month.
Welcome back, George. The teletype's dead as ever. Back to the longevity of the Martian sand lizard.
Truro Nully story played out?
Dead as last week's herring.
Well, what else is new? Maybe we can find another skeleton in the closet. How about life on the Martian moons? Now, that ought to be good for a headline.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. X-1 has brought you Inside Story, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Richard Wilson and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in our cast were Bob Hastings, Leon Janney, Ralph Bell, Richard Hamilton, Edwin Cooper, and Pat Hosley. This is Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production. We pause now for station identification.
X-1, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 20th of June, 1957, the 95th broadcast in that NBC series. And so closes this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden era. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for listening. Thank you.